March is Women's History Month, a time to honor the vital role of women in American history. Our history is dotted with stories of the successes and hardships women faced, particularly as they pursued careers in science. Some women had to overcome stereotypes and other obstacles to stay competitive with their male classmates and coworkers. Some were directed instead toward the life expected of them, to be wives and mothers, a notion that hasn't entirely changed. These women often became role models for the next generation of scientists, though, including those now at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. We've spent most of March talking to some of our female scientists about the people who inspired them. They shared stories about family, colleagues, teachers, and even brief acquaintances who made an impression on them, in some cases driving them toward a career in science, and in other cases encouraging them to stay. Here are the stories of a few people whose history made an impression on six of our scientists who are in the midst of making their own history today. Laura Harris, an associate professor at Chesapeake Biological Laboratory, has three inspirations. Two women she met early on who helped her figure out what she wanted to do, and another she met in graduate school who prepared her for a life in the field and any difficulties that may come with it.
So I'm actually a high school dropout, and when I dropped out of high school, I needed a place to go to still do something scholarly. So I'm one of those weird high school dropouts where I actually got good grades all through high school, and there were just personal reasons for me leaving. And I had spent a summer learning to scuba dive, and had been taught to scuba dive by two fantastic women, Diana Steller and Cassandra Roberts, who at the time were graduate students at the Moss Landing Marine Labs in California. And they worked in the laboratory of Dr. Michael Foster, who was one of the real early benthic ecologists, community ecologists, who worked in kelp forests. And when I had this situation where I needed to leave school, I contacted them. So they were just fantastic mentors and sponsors for me. They found me a place to work in the lab. I was basically the diving intern for all the graduate students in Mike Foster's lab. So I really credit Diana and Cassandra for helping me find a way to bridge my leaving high school and figure out what I wanted to do. I'm trained as a biological oceanographer, but most of the work that I do today is as an estuarine and coastal ecologist. And the breadth of my work includes everything from salt marshes and seagrasses and oysters to biogeochemistry and the response of estuaries to work that we're doing to restore them. You know, I think the other person who I really think of as inspiring me to keep doing work in the marine sciences came to me at the University of Rhode Island's Graduate School of Oceanography. There was a lot of people at GSO who helped me, in particular Candace Oviatt, who continues to inspire me. Candace received her PhD in the late 1960s. She was one of the first oceanography female graduates from GSO. They had to change policy on research vessels so that she could go on board those research vessels. The difficulties she had, she never really talked about. Everything that we heard about in terms of her true pioneering status as a woman in oceanography, we heard from her male colleagues who were so impressed by her. I remember hearing one story where in a course that was taught, they visited a nuclear power plant that was under construction at the time, and Candace was initially forbidden from going on site, even though she was part of the class. And none of this Candace would ever talk about, but, you know, for all of us who were female graduate students at that time, it was kind of awesome to hear the war stories, and it just improved our respect for her. Furthermore, Candace was just a power horse in the kind of systems ecology that I do now and so many of us at UMCES do. She created the first whole system energy budget for a salt marsh in Cove, and that paper has been cited hundreds of times. In the 1970s, she started a mesocosm facility that really guided our understanding of nutrient enrichment in estuaries. She was at one point the president of CERF. So, you know, if I think of all of my role models and who really inspired me to think I could do this, Candace was critical to that.
The beach seemed like nothing new to Jackie Grebmeyer, a research professor at Chesapeake Biological Laboratory. She grew up on the California coast, but then she visited a beach with her AP biology teacher.
Well, when I first started, when I was in high school, which is decades and decades ago, I had an AP, Advanced Placement Biology course, and I had one of the first women to be teaching me science, and she was young and active, and we went on field trips, and we went out to the ocean, and I was raised in California, born in San Francisco, raised in Palo Alto, and so we went out always went to the beach when we were growing up, but when I went with her, she pointed to things, you know, there were organisms in the rocks, you know, there were plant life and animal life, and it was low tide, and it was just very exciting to see, you know, you saw marine snails, and you saw flowering sea anemones, and they were all tucked in when they were sitting open and without the water, but flowering when they're inside these pools. And so she was describing how they ate and what they did and how important the environment was. And it was just outside the classroom. So I started looking at the ocean and the coastline differently at that point, and it got me interested in invertebrate zoology, which is what I majored in as an undergraduate at UC Davis. And then I continued on for master's in Stanford UW. And then I did a PhD in Fairbanks. And I always had an interest in invertebrate zoology and marine systems, and then got into more ecosystem analysis and an interest for what societal relationships they have. I'm a biological oceanographer, and I study what's called plasmic benthic coupling. What that means is that we look at processes like plant growth in the water column, phytoplankton, the small organisms at the base of life for, you know, the plant organisms that provide food for all the different animals, like in the water column, zooplankton. That's why they're called zoo, like a zoo. And plankton means they float. And then a lot of that organic matter settles down to the underlying sediments, which is where I'm most interested in. I'm a benthic biologist, so I like to evaluate the what are called macrofauna, the larger organisms that live in or near the surface sediments. And so the work I do is up in the northern Bering and Chukchi Sea. I look at start sampling maybe in March and April, on icebreakers when it's still ice covered, and then go on other cruises to track this development of the bloom, where it goes, how it feeds the underlying sediments. And people might say, well, so what's so interesting about the clams or the worms down there? They're the base of what feeds the big animals like the walruses that that people know about in the Arctic, the gray whales that migrate from Baja, California, all the way north to feed because it's very rich up there. So I like to make connections in the ecosystem. And so that's what fascinates me. That's why I'm interested particularly in the Pacific sector right now, because the ice pullback is so dramatic and organisms are having to adapt, migrate, or change their ways where they're feeding because of that warming that we're seeing in the environmental changes.
Katia Engelhart, an associate research professor at Appalachian Laboratory, was exposed to the world of science through the eyes of her father. But that didn't drive her toward a career in it. At least, not at first. Here's her story.
It's fairly straightforward who inspired me most, and that would be my dad. He's a scientist himself, so he got me out into the field doing his research when I was a kid, and I watched him as he would put together proposals or would come home thinking about things, and sometimes actually not really being there emotionally. He was in his head dreaming about his research, and to some extent, I have to say that that was off-putting, because a lot of times he was just in a different space. And so actually when I grew up and, you know, when I became a teenager, I kind of resisted. being a scientist. So I love animals, and so I really wanted to become a veterinarian. I got the opportunity to actually work with a female scientist, actually a PhD student, and she actually got me out in the field tracking feral horses in the deserts of Nevada and California. So I worked really closely with her. She basically reintroduced me to science and that you can ask all these questions, that you can go out in the field and basically commune with nature. And I essentially rediscovered who my father is and sort of what he taught me throughout my life. And I finally sort of realized that this is really what I wanted to do. So I'm a trained wetland ecologist. I also label myself as a community ecologist who's really interested in biodiversity. I'm passionately in love with biodiversity, want to understand how it's maintained. And then by understanding that, we can also learn how to restore it or how to conserve it. As a scientist, you just have to work so hard. It's not just an 8-to-5-hour job. You can't just turn your brain off. It can be very intense. It's not like that every day, but research can be extremely intense. And so you take that intensity home with you. And sometimes then you're not there. You're actually in a different universe. Now I have two kids at home that, and they're young, and so they demand a lot of emotional energy, and so it becomes a balancing act, actually. My husband is also a scientist, and so it actually really helps too, because he knows me, and he knows the same sort of process, that there's sometimes this huge intensity, and that you can't get away from your research, and when he sees that, he just basically takes over the family life to allow me that freedom to be in a different world. And I do the same thing for him.
When Helen Bailey, associate research professor of Chesapeake Biological Laboratory, was 10 years old, her school welcomed a guest speaker who launched into her presentation with the call of a chimpanzee. It was Jane Goodall, and the impression she made on Helen would prove to be life-changing.
I was inspired by Jane Goodall. She came to my school when I was about 10. And the first thing she did, she came up to do a speech. And the first thing she did is make a sound like a chimpanzee. And it certainly got everyone's attention that this was a greeting call by a chimpanzee. And I think what really inspired me was how the power of observation, just going out and watching these animals in the wild, had led her to understand just how complicated and how similar these animals and their social structure was to humans. And what I really enjoyed about learning about her work was not just the power of scientific discovery, but using that information to make the world a better place. She has worked very hard, having studied these animals in the wild, to now see that those animals in the wild are doing well, and that there are fewer in captivity and conditions that are not ideal. And so I think from that, I was really inspired to do field work, to go out and see animals in their wild environment, and to learn and understand more about them, and then try and actually apply that, whether it's to management or conservation, to try and make sure that we see these animals in the future too. In my own research, I've put a very strong emphasis on the application of science to management, and also to getting that information out to the public. So, for example, on the Whale Watch project that I've worked, we work very closely with NOAA, who are considering recommending reductions in the speed of vessels to help reduce ship strikes, or whether they need to alter the shipping lanes. And so we've been working well, very closely with them, as we look at the movements of these animals to see what action might be appropriate and what would be most effective at reducing ship strikes. When I was 13, we did a school project on an endangered species, and we can pick which species it was. And I happened to pick the blue whale. And as I found out more and more about it, I just became more and more interested. Not only was it exciting to learn about this animal, which is the largest on the planet, but also to realize just how little we knew about this enormous animal. Despite it being so big, it was so enigmatic in our huge oceans. And I just continually tried to find out more, and I volunteered for a few groups where I was doing observations on a boat or on land, watching dolphins, and I just really loved it, and so went on to continue studying them.
Kat Silinski, a senior agent at Appalachian Laboratory, knew she loved nature, but credits a few people she met early on in her life for seeing it a new way.
I was a city kid who loved nature, but had not a lot of exposure to it. And so there were a few experiences which opened my eyes to this opportunity to be, how to be active outside beyond play. And I live very close to the zoo in DC and would spend a lot of time there. And at one point I got to take a course with the zoo vet, or maybe it was the vet assistant. And it was dramatic for me to see in more detail how they maintain the health and welfare of these animals. At the same time, I had the opportunity to volunteer at a nature center and worked closely with a ranger there in Rock Creek Park in D.C. The leader of that workshop and the ranger I worked with, it opened the door to this idea of ways one could pursue careers with the environment. I went to a pretty small Catholic high school, and I had a teacher. We did a course on the Chesapeake Bay. This was in Maryland, in Silver Spring. And there were only maybe 10 girls in the class. And so it was a very intimate experience. And we went on field trips. And we did role-playing, addressing different issues of the bay. And we went to our house. We made a gumbo. We dissected all the organisms, put it in the gumbo. And then, of course, none of the girls would eat it. But it was really, it extended what I described earlier, kind of ignited this interest for me. I went off to university and started in science, and immediately, very quickly, got distracted by media production and went on to pursue a degree in TV and radio production. But I think I had this seed still in me. I had a strong interest in storytelling, but the seed of science remained. And I think, so the next person who sort of had this influence on this path that I was taking was at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography. So at that point, I was in San Diego. And I was fortunate to get an intern position there in their marine biology lab and worked with a wonderful PhD student who influenced me both in terms of his real excitement for the science and his very clear way of explaining the complexities and the way we broke down each problem and solved it. But the other thing that influenced me there were so many stories, and I was constantly drawn to the human component of the research process. So I think that had an influence where I've ended up. I went on and got a PhD in ecology, but after graduating, wanted to integrate that element of story into the work I do, and so moved into science education. And so my research is primarily focused on engaging the public in science, engaging non-scientists in the science process, igniting in them that same excitement I think that I felt when I was younger.
Solange Filoso, assistant research professor at Chesapeake Biological Laboratory, knew she would someday be a scientist, but she didn't realize it might make her choose between career and family. Then one person changed everything.
I'm a biogeochemist, and I work with water quality of fresh waters. I would say that my passion for science comes from my curiosity, but I became interested in environmental science in particular from growing up in Brazil, where I'm from, during a time of extraordinary changes and a very fast pace of environmental degradation. And I thought that by working in the Amazon, I wanted to work with big rivers there, I would be contributing somehow. But if you were not from the Amazon, and I'm from the southern part of Brazil, was difficult, was very difficult to find opportunities. One of my mentors at the university in Brazil told me that if I went to the US, I would find more opportunities to work in the Amazon, and that's what I did. I found a wonderful program at the University of California in Santa Barbara. I applied to grad school there. I got accepted. I got a Brazilian fellowship, and so everything was going really well. But during grad school, I met my husband, and then I ended up changing plans and staying here. That's when I first started to realize that as a woman, and especially as a Latina, it was going to be a challenge to pursue my career in science, especially if I wanted to have a family. And that broke my heart. I thought I had come so far, but then I would have to give up everything. And I guess what I thought at the time was that in order to be competitive in my career, especially in academia, I would have to choose between family or family life and a career. I just thought I couldn't do both. And another fear that I had, another concern that I had, was that I noticed a lack of support system, especially support among women scientists. And being from Brazil, that was surprising to me, because in Brazil, I guess we always had to fight sexism. And so women tend to stick together and support each other. And I didn't see that here. I guess that one of the problems that I had never had a role model of someone that, you know, could be a wonderful scientist and have a family and do everything with ease. Until I met Beth Boyer, she probably doesn't even know this, but she really impressed me. I met her when I was already a postdoc. She was a young assistant professor, and I was amazed that she could really combine amazing competence and professionalism with kindness and compassion. She was supportive, especially of women, and a real role model. And I wish I had met someone like her earlier in my career path here in the US. But I do hope that there are more Beth Boyers out there to serve as role model for young women scientists.
Thanks to all the women who shared their stories. Be sure to visit umces.edu, that's umces.edu, and follow us on Twitter @umces for more. Thanks for listening.